This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good morning. Thank you for joining me for another exciting episode of New Book Network's African American Studies podcast. I am your host, Katrina Anderson. Today, I am joined by Professor Amy Coddington, who is an assistant professor of music at Amherst College. Today, we will be discussing her first book, How Hip Hop Became Hit Pop, Radio, Rap, and Race. Professor Coddington, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks. It's really a pleasure to be here.
So, can you tell us a little bit about the book?
Sure. So, my book tries to explore how hip hop became what people typically would describe as mainstream. I think that word is really racially coded, and I'm sure we're going to talk about that later. But how hip hop became, moved from a subculture based in the South Bronx and in New York sort of generally, and then how it became popular throughout the U.S. The way that I do this is by looking at how hip hop got played on radio stations, which were one of the major promotional tools of the music industry in the 1980s and the 1990s. My book roughly covers 1979, the release of Rapper's Delight by the Sugar Hill Gang, through about 1993. And that era I chose just because it seemed like the most interesting in terms of what's happening within the radio industry, but also within hip hop.
I agree. It is one of the most interesting, and it gives you that historical context as to what is going on. So how did you become interested in this topic, and what made you decide to write about it?
It's a great question. So I'll just preface with this. I'm white. I'm a white girl who grew up in Oregon, which is one of the whitest states in the country, and has a long history of racial discrimination, to say the least. And what I became really interested in hip hop because I listened to the radio. I grew up in a house without a TV, and basically my major source of popular culture was through the radio. And when listening to the radio as a middle schooler, high schooler, hip hop became the sound of popular music. And so part of what I'm trying to tell in this book is a story about how hip hop came to be played on white-oriented radio stations in Oregon as a sort of the sound of the party, right? The sound of like everyone's getting together and having a good time, rather than the kind of standard narrative that we hear about hip hop, which is really about it voicing the experiences of marginalized communities. As a girl from Oregon, I didn't really hear that narrative growing up. Instead, hip hop was like, it just was pop music. And so it took me a while to really understand the kind of history and culture that I was engaging with. And part of what I wanted to tell, the story that I wanted to tell in this book, is how hip hop got sold to people like me, right? So how did it become so popular that it lost any sense of its connection with the culture, or at least was presented in a way so that it lost its connection with its culture?
That makes a lot of sense. And you did a fabulous job of doing that in the book. Now, what type of sources were you using in your analysis?
Yeah, so when I started writing this book, So this book came out of my dissertation, which I worked on at the University of Virginia. And now I finished it up in my faculty position here at Amherst College. And when I wrote my dissertation, one of the first pieces of advice I got from my advisors was just to, you know, I said, well, I want to talk about the way that hip hop has influenced the sound of popular music more generally, right? That was the kind of question I started with. And initially, my advisor said, oh, well, the way to do that is by going and listening to music, right? Go listen to all the music that's popular and see what you can find. And so I spent a summer doing that, and it was great. It was really, really fun. I listened to every song that appeared on the Billboard Hot 100 in the 80s and in the 90s. It was a ton of music, and a lot of it I already knew, but some of it was brand new to me, so that was really exciting. But I got to the end of that, and I said, well, I don't know if my impressions about what, you know, my sort of interaction with this music is really what I want to talk about. I actually want to talk about how this music, right, why did it become popular? And to me, what that led me to was thinking about was looking through music industry periodicals, right? The kind of sources that are trade journals for people working in the music industry. And so at that point, I sort of shifted my emphasis from listening to reading, and I found a full run of Billboard magazine, which is kind of the music industry's Bible. And I just started reading it. And in those pages, I found a lot of stuff that I felt like no one was talking about. And in particular, one of the things I thought that most people in the field of music studies writ large, which is a super interdisciplinary world, one of the things that people really weren't talking about was the influence of radio on the sound of popular music. So I think we oftentimes think about record labels. Oh, you know, they're always, record labels are telling artists what sort of music to make, which is absolutely true, right? Record labels act as like a sort of a prominent gatekeeper within the music industry, but actually they're also being influenced by what radio stations are doing. And radio stations are also in turn being influenced by their economic model, which basically says that if you're running a commercial radio station in the US, the way you make money is by selling advertisements to companies that really aren't like that aren't interested in music necessarily. These are like the car dealerships that that advertise on the radio, or Procter & Gamble, one of the highest during the 1980s and 1990s, was one of the like most prolific advertisers. And those people have really specific interests in terms of who they're targeting. Because they have specific interests in who they're targeting, that influences what music gets played on the radio, which then in turn influences both the sort of popularity, but also the exact sound of what record labels are doing. And that influences then what we as listeners hear. And so the kind of chain from advertisers through the radio industry to listeners, that was what really, after a while, took me a while to find this, I finally figured out that that was sort of the crux of what I was interested in. And so in terms of, to get back to sources, long-winded answer to this question, to me, what I was really interested in was what radio programmers were saying about the music they played and how they justified the choices they made. So were they getting pressure from their sales office to play music that would target white audiences, or were they able somehow to kind of create a more diverse listener base, which oftentimes then meant a more diverse playlist. And throughout the 1980s and into the 1990s, these are huge questions throughout the radio industry. And so this felt like a really, like, to me at least, an interesting question to think about the way that culture is deeply tied to its role as a commodity, that music isn't just like the free expression of people, but actually that it is also something that's being sold to us as audience members.
That makes a lot of sense. And you, within the book that you created, you exemplified everything that you set out to do. And so I want to ask you, how was the writing process for the book?
It's a good question. I mean, I assume you sort of know this part of the process, but writing is hard. Researching for me is like a real joy. I love like going into a large part of this book I researched in like a closed section of the library that was freezing cold. And I was sort of like rustling through old periodicals. I love that portion of it, right? I love kind of like diving in and seeing what the discourse of the day is. But then, of course, at the end of this, you do have to write it. And so I've been really lucky at my institution to get to have gotten a year of research leave where I basically wrote the thing or finished writing the thing. And that being able to dive into it during that year, I think was really helped me realize the pleasure along with the pain of the writing process. But it did take a while. I've been working on this material or the subject for about 9 years between the dissertation and then writing the book now.
Your book is very well written and it's easy to read. So I know writing it's so hard. And believe me, I get it. But you did a fabulous job with it.
Thank
I want to say that.
Yeah, so. I'll just say one thing. One of my goals in writing this book was to try and write it in a way that my students who are all undergrads could read it and could read it in ways that like maybe parts of it would be a little bit difficult and a little technical, but like that the jargon and the sort of you know, the academic writing wouldn't get in the way of it. And so that, to me, was really important that this sounded a little bit like my own voice, but it also sounded like something that was teachable. And so I hope that that comes through. It's one of the reasons why the book is available open access. And so I'm really hoping that people will teach this in their classes and everything. Like, for me, that's the kind of joy of writing is feeling like that someone can use it. And so I'm hoping that's the case.
I hope so. I really do, because it's great. That's all I can say. It's fabulous.
Thanks. So thank you.
Let's dive into the book. So let's talk a little bit about, you know, you mentioned early on this idea of Black oriented radio format. Can you explain that for listeners so they can understand what that was?
Sure. So for most of its existence, so the last century or so, the radio industry has largely thought about audiences according to race, right? So in the 1920s, as we're sort of, as the radio industry is operating on a network structure, so there's these major networks that are now our TV networks, so like ABC, NBC, they're primarily making programming for white audiences. And when they're not making programming for white audiences, it's very, very clear, right? So they're really demarcating audiences by race. I think this is no surprise given exactly what's happening in the country at that same time, right? Like the US is this extremely, right? Most of the organization of the US is operated on along segregated lines. And so, as we move into the kind of contemporary formatting era, which starts in roughly the 1970s, what happens is that radio formats, because they are trying to sort of target more niche audiences than they had previously to that point, what they start doing is creating specific stations for specific types of people. So you might think about this as I think the easiest to understand station in this regard is an adult contemporary station, which means a station that's really aimed, it's playing, quote, contemporary music for adults, right? So its target is really clear within its name. One of the other types of stations whose targeting is really clear is what are oftentimes in the 80s, they're referred to as Black stations. They also get called urban stations. In my book, I sort of lump these together, although they're very different stations, but I call these Black-oriented stations, basically to say that these are stations that are primarily trying to attract Black audiences. There's a couple other formats that are important during this era, and I'll just kind of list them off so that we have these terms in our heads. So there's the country music station, which is a age-diverse, primarily white audience-based station. There's rock stations, which are also aiming for white audiences and typically male audiences. And then the other kind of catch-all term for radio stations are these top 40 radio stations. These are sometimes referred to as pop radio stations because they play a lot of pop music. But at their most ideal, these top 40 stations are interested in playing music That appeals to everybody, right? The most popular songs in the country, the quote unquote top 40. And so in the 1970s through the 80s, 90s into today, these are kind of the five primary radio formats that the radio industry is the organization is divided into.
That makes a lot of sense. And hearing you say, you know, these different substations that you have, rock and adult contemporary and urban, also black stations and pop, that makes a lot of sense given the time period of what was going on.
So, yeah, and I'll also just add that these stations, right, so throughout the 1970s into the 80s, these formats are trying to refine their playlists to basically appeal to a certain segment of the American public so that they can sell that segment to advertisers, right? So I just want to draw this line back to the advertising industry, which is saying, well, in the 1950s, for example, there are advertisers that say, well, we don't mind advertising to white and black audiences, but we don't want to do it at the same time, right? So we really do need to divide these audiences up. Again, this is a pretty, this is an extremely simplistic and I think wrong vision of the American public throughout the 20th century. But this is how the advertising industry is influencing the radio industry to operate.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. And so I want to ask you, then why was it so difficult to have, you know, rap on radio stations in the 1980s? And why was it, you know, considered quote unquote too black?
Yeah, the quote that you just quoted there is usually attributed to a black programmer at a New York station, WBLS, Frankie Crocker, who's by far in the 1980s probably the most influential black programmer in the country. And he, in facing the sort of the first releases of hip hop on record, so this would be Rapper's Delight and other releases kind of post that, he says, no, I can't play those on WBLS because they're quote unquote too black for our station. Too black here means a variety of things, right? So at this moment, Frankie Crocker, WBLS, is moving towards what they're describing as an urban contemporary format rather than a black format, which in this period means they're trying to appeal to more white listeners. And so they think, well, rap really isn't going to appeal to those listeners, so we can't play it, right? That's the kind of racialized way of thinking about this. There's also an economic side of this. So the reason that they're trying to appeal to more white listeners is because advertisers will pay more for white listeners than they would for black listeners in the 1980s. But I can kind of use the present tense here, too, because this hasn't changed much over the last 40 years. They're trying to attract more lucrative listeners. And so that also, right, too black in this context means something about both a, it's about race, but it's also about economic class, but it's also about the mixture of those two things, right? So rap comes from disenfranchised, underprivileged young kids making music in the South Bronx, which that style of music, Frankie Crocker, who's trying for more of an affluent audience, really isn't interested in. So it's not just that it's a, right, not just that this music was too black, it was also too poor, and it was also the mix of those two things.
Right. That makes a lot of sense, especially given the time period and everything that was going on. But all of this changes.
Yeah.
In 1986, you have Jeff Wyatt and Power 106. They switch things up a little bit. So can you talk about that?
Yeah. So I think it's important here to note that the record and radio industry, because they're dividing things along these racialized lines, they've got a bit of a problem here, right? So oftentimes what they want their artists to do is appeal to these racialized bases, but then also appeal more widely. And so this appealing more widely is called, in the industry, they call this crossing over, meaning if you sort of start with a black base, You find some white listeners maybe on your second or third single. If you start with a white base, let's say Madonna, you might find black listeners as well later on in your career. This crossover move for black artists was really dependent upon their success at black radio stations. So if rappers weren't being played on black-oriented radio stations, they really didn't have any chance of being marketed towards a broader audience because the industry just didn't think they were going to make it if they hadn't made it on black-oriented stations. And so in the mid-1980s, a number of radio stations across the country, largely in major metropolitan areas, they start broadcasting a new style of radio format. And I call this, at the time, it was usually referred to as the crossover format. Now it's more oftentimes called a rhythmic or rhythmic contemporary station. And these crossover stations were places for artists of a variety of racial and ethnic backgrounds to make music for audiences of similar racial and ethnic backgrounds. So in Los Angeles with Power 106, this meant that they were interested in what they thought of as a kind of three-part audience. Los Angeles's black population, they're what they're calling their Hispanic population, and then their white population. Across the country, the kind of in different major metropolitan areas, once these stations start springing up, those audiences, the sort of composition varies considerably due to the composition of what the city's actual demographics are. But across the country, these stations start springing up that are playing music that's really aimed towards this crossover audience. These stations find ways to monetize what in the industry is pretty rare. This is a multi-ethnic, multiracial audience. In an industry that really divides audiences by race, these stations are pretty unique for their ability to kind of smush everyone together and to make money off of it. And so they do this by primarily aiming their stations towards young audiences that are interested in dance music. So at the time, what they're playing is like a lot of R&B, a lot of kind of danceable pop, and a ton of freestyle. And freestyle comes out of the same communities that hip hop comes out of. So it's kind of no stretch for rap to start being played, for these stations to start playing rap, because they're already playing music that sort of appeals to these same audiences. And in particular, rap kind of forms a glue across this multi-ethnic and multiracial audience that programmers notice that rap sort of starts appealing to all of these various segments in ways that pop, for example, maybe doesn't. To me, crossover stations create a kind of economic platform for rap to cross over in ways that black-oriented radio stations weren't able to do as much because they couldn't commodify the same types of audiences. And so they offer this kind of springboard for rap then to cross over onto top 40 stations and find their way to for rap artists to find their way to much broader audiences. I don't really give this in the book. I don't offer a kind of optimistic tone of this. A lot is lost in this process. As rap crosses over, it's largely the people who are in control of both crossover and top 40 radio stations. They're mostly white. And so they take a lot of the economic power that's building within the rap music industry, and they start controlling that economic and, we might say, social and cultural power. And so for me, this story of kind of rap's crossover, it's not this like amazing, oh my goodness, look what rap has become, right? There's also a lot of, within the details of this, I think we lose a lot of the sense of what rap was, is what rap artists are trying to create within their culture. And so we see this as the 80s progress into the 90s. I think this debate comes up a lot around the artists, MC Hammer and Vanilla Ice, who within the rap community, for the most part, are thought of as people that don't belong there. But if you're listening to the radio, what you're hearing as rap is MC Hammer and Vanilla Ice. And so we get this kind of division between what music has crossed over and also, and then the music that hip hop artists are, and the sort of ideas that hip hop artists are trying to cultivate.
That makes a lot of sense. It's it, but there's a lot, you know, as you're correct, that is lost, you know, as it's becoming more commercialized during this time, AKA sellable.
Yes. Yeah.
That's the goal here, is how to make this more marketing of hip hop and rap during this time. And so I want to ask, you know, with those top, as you're thinking about like the top 40 programmers, they have a specific audience that they want to target. And yeah, typically that's the women who are over the age of 25. That's what they want to gear that to. So how did that relate, you know, to rap? How are they able to introduce their that particular demographic to rap?
Yeah, so during this era, top 40 stations are really thinking of themselves as stations for both a kind of teenage audience and then women, white women in particular, over the age of 25, usually 25 to 35, because at a certain point, most white women are going to age out of the top 40 format and find their way into country or adult contemporary stations. Because rap during this era is extremely popular with teenagers, but not so much with these white women over the age of 25, top 40 programmers are really in kind of a pickle. They need to be able to find rap songs that appeal to both of these audiences. And they do this in a variety of ways that are going to sound really familiar to actually what hip hop sounds like in 2023. So they start taking songs from these old, like the white women's youth, and they start putting rap vocals to them. So we might think about this as like Jack Harlow covering Fergie's song that just came out, First Class. I guess it came out, you know, about a year ago. They do this by introducing what has been a very, very successful crossover vehicle, the ballad, to rap, right? So having artists like LL Cool J start performing these kind of slow love songs that they think are going to better appeal to this white woman audience. And then they also try and do things like promote artists like DJ Jazzy Jeff and The Fresh Prince, who I describe in the book as making music that really, really neatly appeals to grownups and kids at once, right? A song like Parents Just Don't Understand is going to appeal to kids, right? It's saying the thing that kids say a lot, but it's also going to appeal to grownups because it's kind of funny, right? And so it's right, both of these audiences can enjoy the song together. And so that's the kind of multi-demographic hit that top 40 programmers are really looking for. You'll notice as I've been talking about the music here, I'm not describing any of the artists that I think we think of in the pantheon of golden era hip hop. We're not talking about Public Enemy. We're not talking about Rakim. We're not talking about NWA. We're not talking about Nas, right? None of those artists are big on the radio simply because they're not able to, or it's not able. It is that radio programmers do not think that they are able to appeal to these types of audiences. And so again, the kind of rap that's sellable is an entirely different, it's a category that I describe in the book that it overlaps with the kind of hip hop that we, you know, that are in when we think of like the greatest rappers of all time. Some of these rappers are being played on the radio, some are not though. And so this creates this kind of sense of that the things that are on, like the rap that's on the radio maybe isn't quote unquote the real stuff. And this question of whether rap on the radio is quote unquote the real stuff becomes a kind of defining sense, a defining question for the genre as it becomes more and more popular.
That makes sense. And when you said, I was thinking about those songs, like from LL Cool J, and DJ Jazzy Jeff, and Parents Don't Understand. It appeals parents and children. And then I thought of their other song, Summertime.
Yeah.
And you know how much and how often that was played, and I can see, you know, this, it has that dual appeal to both the groups. And you're right, you don't see that normal pantheon of what is definitive hip hop making that particular list during this time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I can definitely see that happening. Now, as rap simultaneously is gaining more prominence, there were, you know, and you talk about this in your book, there were two rap-free sub-formats that were also developing to provide, like, that alternative to as rap is being more, well, introduced more. So you have rock and the adult top 40. I remember reading about the rock. Can you say how that fared in this new market space?
Yeah, so basically as rap becomes entirely part of the top 40 format. So for example, this is the era where like MC Hammer and Vanilla Ice, they're vying for the number one and number two spots on the top albums chart for more weeks than any other two albums since the album chart existed in the first place. These are huge, huge artists, and there's plenty more like them, right? LL Cool J is huge at this moment. Bell Biv DeVoe, artists like that that are being played all the time on top 40 radio. As this happens, some radio programmers start deciding that, well, maybe this rap thing has gone a little too far. I oftentimes show in my research, and this is in the book, there's an advertisement that Rick Dees, who used to run and host one of the major top 40 countdowns, Rick Dees and the weekly top 40, something like that.
Remember it?
Yeah, exactly. So Rick Dees, at this point, he puts out an ad that says, basically, like, rap should be dead. The ad features a literal gravestone that says RIP rap on it. And he says that rap is getting too hard to program, right? It's just not gonna, in his words, rap isn't gonna cut it anymore. And so he says, we really need to stop playing rap and we need to move to a more mainstream format. This is where, right, a clear indication of the way that mainstream doesn't mean anything about popularity. Mainstream doesn't mean anything about whether it's appealing to a broad audience. It actually means something about it appealing to a white audience when Rick Dees uses that word. And so as rap becomes more and more popular, radio programmers who have long been reticent to play rap in the first place, their radio programmers really have never bought into the genre, they start developing these what they call rap-free sub-formats of the top 40. So there's one that's more rock oriented. This is called Rock 40. And the most popular of these stations pops up in Los Angeles. It's called Pirate Radio. And actually, Pirate Radio was a nationally syndicated, they had a nationally syndicated show. So even if you weren't in LA, you might have heard Pirate Radio, where they're playing kind of like the rockiest pop songs and the poppiest rock songs. But very, very explicitly, they're not playing anything that crossover stations are playing, meaning rap and dance music. They kind of bubble up, but it's not actually that financially viable of a format because the young men that these stations are appealing to don't prove to be all that commodifiable. Later on in the chapter, I talk about a type of station that still exists to this day and is probably, if you have a top 40 station in your town, if you don't live in a major metropolitan area, it's likely to be what's described as an adult top 40 station, which were top 40 stations that were aimed at sort of the top age demographic, right? Women, 25, 35. And they pretty explicitly did not play rap either. They would run commercials that said things like, and here's your rap free work day, or, you know, no rap, we don't play any of that rap stuff on our station. And to me, these both of these formats articulate the kind, they articulate a wedge that's happening that radio programmers are trying, that radio programmers are sort of creating a wedge between the various factions of their audience and are really using rap as a scapegoat for this. But also, to me, this really articulates the kind of changing ideas of race in the U.S. as multiculturalism is coming to be the kind of default way of understanding the U.S. public. So as, you know, schools across the country are changing their reading lists to embrace more diverse authors, as like Crayola puts out new skin tone crayons, all of a sudden there's a sense that, oh, diversity is great. But within the American public, I think we oftentimes need, we don't need, how do I say this? I think that oftentimes we are led to believe that we need a kind of scapegoat, right? That there's good people and there's not as good people. And one of the wedges that's formed in the American public here is actually about rap and is about sort of urban life and is about a sense in, and this is coming out of kind of politics writ large across the country, that urban spaces maybe aren't as safe as they could be, and demonizing a kind of racialized other. And rap certainly gets swept into this discourse. So rap is being criticized in the early 90s and late 1980s as music that's, you know, too profane for our kids. It's right, it's giving them, you know, it's got too many swear words. It's talking about lifestyles that we don't want our kids hearing. That discourse, I think, is really trying to kind of create a, put rap in a place where it doesn't belong in the kind of normative white mainstream. And these stations are really, they're sort of central in that, in sort of creating a discourse where rap is seen as a kind of other, even though the fact, even despite the fact that it's one of the most popular genres in the country by that point.
That makes a lot of sense. The way it needs to be said, okay, it's not appropriate for our children. They should not listen to it.
Or our workplaces, right? That rap just isn't, it's not for everybody, right? I often heard when I was growing up a phrase that was, you can't spell crap without rap, right? There's no similar phrase for like rock, you know, because rap is sort of has become, right, both the most popular genre in the country at this point, but it's also still simultaneously seen as not necessarily part of the mainstream. And we see this all over the place. So when I was in college, I was in Charlottesville, Virginia, and listening to, they had a top 40 station in Charlottesville that did not play any rap songs unless they were by white artists. To me, that says a lot about the position of rap within our world, even as we're celebrating it, given this is, you know, hip hop's 50th anniversary. I think we are seeing this kind of increasing celebratory language about hip hop, but I don't think what's happened is that this has changed the way hip hop has, even our celebration of the genre hasn't changed the way that we're still sort of scapegoating the genre. And I think it hasn't changed the way that we, people in the US, think about race.
I agree with that assessment wholeheartedly. And so what they were able to do during this period, and in some ways what's continued to be done, although that's changing some, is re-segregate the airwaves.
Yes. Yeah.
In terms of what should or should not, and who's who is going to be the consumer, and where you're able to listen, and where you're able to find, and what exposure that it has, you want to marginalize it so much that it's only in a limited variety that you'll be able to actually find it.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, because I think, I mean, and this is similar to the way that people thought about rock and roll in the 1950s. Many, many sort of white media industry moguls thought about rap as really a challenge to their, the kind of the vision of mainstream America that they were promoting. And so these stations helped kind of put rap in a box where it could live as this kind of challenge, but never actually do the work of challenging, if that makes sense.
That makes a lot of sense. And I think 1950s, you know how during that period, you know, as you mentioned, someone like Elvis, controversial. Yet, you know, when you look in hindsight, it's who he became and what he was. And so that kind of also leads us to rap and how big a phenomenon it actually ended up being and that it is today. So, you know, like in 2023, you know, it's one of the biggest music genres that there is in so many ways. How does all of this connect to us in 2023 in this moment that we're living in right now?
That's a great question. So there's maybe a couple answers to this. One of the answers is that I don't think rap would be the most popular genre in the world were it not for the kind of incessant commodification of the genre that happens in the late 80s and early 90s. I think in many ways that moment is necessary both to commercialize the genre, but also to create a discourse within people who are really invested in articulating a different style of rap, to have something to kind of like push against, right? So if, you know, the white girl in Oregon thinks that rap is MC Hammer and Vanilla Ice, the people who are creating hip hop in Oregon that are maybe a couple years older than her, right, that they can start articulating a vision that's not that. And so I think in many ways, the genre is, its popularity is indebted to this moment, but also the way that we think about hip hop as being this, as having this kind of endless possibility of political, right, of speaking, of allowing people, of giving a platform for people's political voices and for giving a microphone to marginalized communities across the world. I think without the kind of flip side of that, it's hard to maintain that identity. And so to me, I think one of the things that is important about the moment I talk about is that it both creates the growth, right? It helps lead to the growth of the genre, but it also helps define the genre's identity. I think one of the funny things that about writing this book in 20, you know, this book coming out this year, is that oftentimes I hear a lot of people saying, well, yeah, hip hop's enormous, but like radio is dead, right? And to me, the question of radio being, I mean, anyone you talk to within the radio industry would say, no, we're doing great. You know, sales, advertising sales, yeah, they're down, but they're not down that much. And time spent listening, which is the metric by which radio stations measure their kind of audiences, time spent listening has remained pretty steady, maybe over the last 10 years or so. I think anyone who is living on, you know, in the US knows those things not to be true. I think radio certainly is decreasing in popularity, and particularly top 40 stations are. I think, you know, country radio stations are doing just fine. But top 40 rhythmic stations, hip hop stations, any of these really contemporary music stations that are aimed at young audiences are finding other places to listen to for music. What I don't think that means is that the story about radio is doesn't kind of shed light on our contemporary moment. And here's what I mean by that. I think we live in a world where we spend a ton of time on the internet. And the internet, unless you're paying for the services, is largely paid for by advertising, right? If you're like looking at a food blog, the food blogger is making money via the advertisements that are there. If you're on Facebook, Facebook is making money via advertisements, all, et cetera, et cetera. To me, I think one of the things the book that I wanted to highlight in my book is the way that the advertising industry really influences the media we consume. And I don't think that this is a story that's limited to radio. To me, this is pretty self-evident if you look at, you know, the stories about Cambridge Analytica on Facebook, about, you know, the kind of like the recent elections and the way that Facebook kind of, you know, promotes certain stories versus other ones to keep people on the platform. And part of that is because they need eyes to pay those advertisers. And so I hope that my book helps illustrate the influence of the world, the kind of advertiser-driven marketplace that we all exist in today.
That makes a lot of sense, because, you know, now, you know, with there is radio, and I'm sure, but it's not where it used to be, because as you mentioned, there's a lot of other streaming platforms that are there.
Yes.
That everyone has access to, yeah. That are used much more frequently now than radios per se, or listening to radio stations. So things have changed by the time we've gotten to 2023. So I want to ask you, what do you want readers to take away from the book?
That's a great question. I think for me, the most important here's what I hope my book helps illustrate. Artists, I think that we oftentimes criticize art, right? As musicians or listeners of music, we often criticize artists for choices that they make. We say, well, you know, Drake's really selling out when he puts out this song, or like, you know, J. Cole, he totally sold out, right? We have this sense of artists making commercial choices, and we don't necessarily, as listeners, like those commercial choices they're making. I hope that my book gives context to help readers understand the pretty unique position that that musical artists are in. It's rare for an artist to have pure and total artistic agency over their music. And I think the exceptions to this largely prove the rule. And to me, I think one of the things that I hope readers take away from the book is a sense that the actors that influence what music we hear as consumers, some of them are really musical geniuses, right? So there's a number of great leaders of record labels and people who work in A&R that have done amazing, amazing things for artists. But there are a lot of people who are not interested in developing artists or interested in kind of musical innovation writ large that have influence on the music industry. Some of those people work in record labels, lots of those people work in radio, and lots of those people work in advertising industries. And so to me, I hope that one of the things that this book does is ask listeners to give artists a little more grace when it comes to thinking about the choices they've made in their careers. Because this is an incredibly difficult industry to operate in. And I think the fact that artists are making music at all is an absolutely beautiful thing.
I agree with that assessment wholeheartedly. So, you know, thank you so much for joining me today, Professor Coddington, and sharing more about your fabulous new book.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you.
Readers, please go out and pick up a copy of How Hip Hop Became Hit Pop. I assure you, you will not regret it. It is something that is highly readable for both academics and non-academics alike, and you can learn more about the history of what is now one of the preeminent genres in music. And Professor Coddington, she weaves her tales so flawlessly that you're able to see the intricacies that have been built within music and radio. You're able to understand how rap in some ways became what it did. And so please go out and pick up a copy of this fabulous new book today.